Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Up first are the Angry Kids, Canada's hottest DJ and production duo. They talk about their brand new debut self-titled album and what it took to put it all together, as well as how they became the Angry Kids and who they want to work with in the future. We then celebrate Movember by talking to Mike Jeffcott about this year's initiatives and why men's mental health is so important, along with prostate cancer awareness. We then wrap things up with our etiquette expert, Karen Cleveland, and the ins and outs of handling yourself on a date.
Capture your need for sound.
I'm very excited to welcome our next guests to the show. These guys are Canada's hottest DJ production remix team known as the Angry Kids, and they're making noise with their amazing remix skills, working on tracks from Tiësto, 30 Seconds to Mars, Lights, Victoria Duffield. The list goes on and on. They're also making people bounce across the country with their very popular Angry Kids hit fix that can be heard on Virgin Radio in Montreal, Toronto, Edmonton, Calgary, London, and Winnipeg. And on top of all of that, they have just released their debut self-titled album, which we're going to speak to them all about. Ryan and Jeff of the Angry Kids, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey. Well, thanks very much. It's good to be here.
We're fantastic, and I'm so happy to have the two of you. And I wanted to, I guess, start off by letting the people know how the Angry Kids met and became the Angry Kids.
Jeff, you can do it this time.
Ryan and I have history in business, kind of dating beyond this project. Ryan used to do some record label stuff, and I was doing music licensing at the time, and, you know, our paths crossed then. Ryan had the idea for this project and ultimately came and, you know, proposed it to me. I stepped up and helped see through some of the stuff that Ryan was looking to do.
Now, did you guys know that you had chemistry right from the start, or was it sort of like a sports team where you had to run a few drills to see how, and get the chemistry and the gelling going?
Well, the good thing about it is when I was looking, I was trying to seek out people or somebody to do this with me. I was kind of coming into it cold, coming from the business side. I didn't know what it took exactly to do a lot of this production stuff. And we really got an opportunity to grow together. And by growing together, I think we've become like that, you know, like it's almost like, you know, like you said, you compared it to a team. It's like two draft picks coming into a league and growing, kind of like, you know, Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan or something like that. They just grew into this great synergy together.
And what were your goals when you started working together? Was it always to put out an album? Did you have like specific things that you knew you wanted to do?
Our goal was to work towards an album. Absolutely. At least it was mine. I'm hoping it was Jeff too.
Oh yeah. I love doing original stuff. I love doing remixes, and the opportunity to do both with this project has definitely been a goal.
And the fact that I want to explain as well, which I just found out because I didn't realize this. So one of you is in Toronto, one of you is in Calgary. What is that like logistically to make things happen?
It's the power of the internet.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we do today that I don't think was possible 10 years ago. You know, Ryan and I work from our separate studios, but everything is linked through a central server that we run and maintain our own. So, when Ryan is working on a project, he can click save, and at the same time, I can open that project in Calgary and hear and see almost exactly what he's doing right away. And it just makes it really easy for us to bounce ideas off each other and, you know, really get the workflow working, being that we can't be in the same room at the same time.
Really all done also by we both have the exact same setups on our computers.
Oh, perfect.
Which allows it to be able to just, you know, click open and away you go.
Okay, so that makes things a lot easier. And I wanted to ask as well, where did the idea come, you know, to create the hit fix where you guys are mixing these amazingly hot songs like Rihanna, Katy Perry, Gautier? Like, it's just all happening. And I've had the pleasure of getting to play some of your hit fixes, and it really, you know, makes me move, and I know it makes our audience move. So how did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
We were shopping a record of ours. We had a record that was charting in the UK. It was our rejig of Nick Kershaw's Wouldn't It Be Good. And I had sent it to some select stations. I called Virgin Toronto, and Virgin Toronto said, like, you know, we can't play this out of the box, but I have a question for you. Can you guys produce a radio mix show like you produce music? And without even asking Jeff, I kind of said, yeah, of course we can. they gave us a week to gave me a week to do it. Got on the phone with Jeff, and we had the demo back in what, like 48 hours?
Yeah, it was pretty quick. Yeah, we already kind of knew, you know, how we wanted that to sound. As soon as the idea was presented to us, it sort of just, oh yeah, we could do that.
Amazing. And it sounds amazing, and it's awesome to listen to and to get to play. Joining us on the show are DJs and remixers Ryan and Jeff of The Angry Kids. Make sure you check them out on Twitter at The Angry Kids. Also their website, theangrykids.com. How did you guys, you know, I guess start to get noticed in a way? Like, obviously you got noticed this particular way with Virgin Radio in Toronto, but how did you start getting your stuff on the radar?
I think it was our first the first record we had that started to make an impact, which was our Mr. Brown featuring Bob Marley. It got to number one in Canada, and got on the radio here. And when we did that record, it was really the only thing we had done. You know, people started to contact us for remix services and different things, and it's just kind of started growing further and further from there.
And when it comes to being commissioned or requested by other artists, like, how does that happen? Is it now because of word of mouth? And obviously now you guys have this Angry Kids hit fix that we hear, you know, every week on so many stations across the country. So is word just getting out now, and now you're being approached? Are you, or do you still actively have to network?
I don't know. I don't think we ever really did. I think people always kind of found us.
Yeah, it's funny because I think we're pretty low-key. You know, we're easygoing and just kind of go with it as it comes to us. You know, I don't think either of us have really, you know, done that kind of force it down your throat kind of thing. You know, we sort of prefer to, you know, let our work speak for itself. And when somebody likes what we do and is interested in what we do, you know, good things come together.
How do you go about picking the songs that you've worked on, like the Bob Marley thing, or I know that there's a Flock of Seagulls as well?
We have a partner that we deal with that has a large catalog, and we sort of looked through his catalog and handpicked a few things to work at. And while, you know, the Bob Marley, the Nick Kershaw, and the Flock of Seagulls are on our album, there was a multitude of others that were looked at and just really didn't do what we wanted them to do. The Marley remix, I think, Jeff, you know, that was started, what, like 6 or 7 different times?
Yeah. Once we had the parts and started working on it, I went through several revisions before we ended up with, you know, what ultimately made the album. But, yeah, sometimes it's a matter of hearing something and just trying to sit back and imagine what can be done with it and what else you can do to it. If you could reimagine a song that already exists in a light that doesn't exist yet, you know, what would you do with it? And, you know, these records that we have on our album that work this way, you know, are really that matter of we found something that really works for us.
Do you guys consider yourselves instrumentalists or programmers or both?
Both. Definitely both.
Fantastic. And can you tell us, you know, is it mainly keyboards that you're using, or do you actually, like, program, or do you play live instruments as well and incorporate that at some point?
I can play one. Jeff can't. Ha ha.
No, neither of us are amazingly awesome on any instrument. I mean, we definitely work with keyboards. I mean, Ryan's done some guitar stuff in the past, but no, for the most part, everything is keyboard based and sample based. And you know, we find ways to, you know, if we need a, you know, xylophone sample in something we're doing, you know, we'll find a good you know, recording of, map it to a keyboard, properly sample it out, and then play it back. Means that we're more familiar with.
Yeah, our album is pretty much, you could say, the traditional sense of a soft synth and a drum machine is what we use to make it, and a microphone.
Fantastic. And I want to speak to you about the album itself. Now, it's self-titled, so The Angry Kids. You do have these songs like we talked about with The Flock of Seagulls and the Bob Marley, but then there's also original tracks that you've worked on. Can you speak to us about those original tracks? Like, you know, did you both write them together? Like, how did that happen?
There was a process. It was a lot of it was kind of someone working on something and just bouncing ideas back and forth. There was one song on the album called Generation, which I really just had a drum beat programmed, and I put it on my iPod, and I listened to it when I was traveling around India just over and over, and I wrote the lyrics and then gave the lyrics and the drum pattern to Jeff and said, make this into a song.
No pressure, eh, Jeff?
It came together, you know, surprisingly. You know, once I kind of, you know, had the typed out version of what Ryan had for lyrics, and, you know, we kind of had tempo and a rough structure put together. I mean, the rest kind of chords came from there, and then production came around the chords, and it just kind of worked like that. But yeah, in the case of the originals, that's, you know, it's definitely a collaborative process. I mean, one of us might start with an idea, but by the time we hit the actual finished version, it's gone back and forth between the two of us at least 2 or 3 dozen times.
When it comes to the vocalists, how do you pick them or who do you want to work with?
Well, the vocalists on the album, one of them is actually myself.
Nice.
The male vocals. And then Odyssey is someone who's a friend of ours. And she had, we had worked on something and Dylan Rhymes had said, you know, you should really send this to Haley. And we sent it to her and she came back with just this dark yet lovely lyric that she recorded and actually kind of really changed what we had.
Yeah, that was another instance of us starting with some instrumental production. You know, it bouncing off us a couple times, going to someone else, and then have Odyssey come back with, you know, some lyrics to it. Once we heard what she had done, it completely changed the tone of the record, and it became Lullaby. But although that wasn't the original intention for the production when we started doing it.
Now, when it comes to these songs and other songs that you guys are going to work on in the future, because obviously that's going to happen, do you have like a hit list of artists that you would like to work with? Or do you like working with people that might be a bit under the radar?
I think both. I think Ryan and I definitely have some people who we'd love to work with. And, you know, some of which are in the works. You know, now with the deal with Warner, we've actually got some people behind us who help make things like that happen. But at the same time, it's fun working with somebody who's, you know, a hidden talent that nobody else really knows yet. I answered the question, both.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for us was when we were making this record, we did it all ourselves. We didn't have an outside party there, you know, looking to solicit vocalists for our music. It was just really, you know, who we knew, who we could get ourselves involved with, and there wasn't that kind of that outside influence. I think it's going to make album 2 probably more fun and possibly a little easier to get the ideas flowing.
Amazing. And I wanted to touch on the social media aspect of things. We talked a little bit before about how the fact that, you know, one of you is in Toronto, one of you is in Calgary, so obviously internet, very important for your work. When it comes to social media aspects, how important for you is Facebook, is Twitter?
It's important, and it's funny you bring it up, because often people who we know say that they can tell who's tweeting based on what we write.
Yeah, we both have Twitter and Facebook on each of our cell phones. So when, if I'm doing something, I'll tweet it. But, you know, I generally try to put my name on it. Ryan just writes something, and everybody always knows it's Ryan.
Yeah, I'm the bad seed of the bunch.
You must be the one that I had the Twitter conversation with about beer then. That must have been you, Ryan.
Probably, yes. More than likely.
I think so. I think that's what happened.
Yes, it was on a Sunday morning at like 6.
Yes, it was bright and early. And then we somehow got from that into the fact that you're a big Minnesota Vikings fan. Is that correct?
That is, yeah, because I asked you down to the Peel Pub to come watch the game for me, being nowhere near it.
Exactly. That was going to work out fine. I could have FaceTimed you. It would have been awesome.
It would have been great. Yeah.
Now, what is up next for you two? Like, you have the album out. Obviously, it just came out. But where do the Angry Kids go from here?
Wow.
Some shows. We've definitely got some shows coming up. We've got, I don't know if we can mention specifics yet, but we definitely have some live DJ gigs coming. Trying to spread the hit fix a little bit more across the country. And, you know, we're starting work on album number 2 already. You know, it's never too early to start, you know, getting track ideas and start lining up some samples and working with some vocalists.
Yeah, and we've also got there's a couple artists that you will see in the next while who have got us to kind of take what they've done scratch track-wise and readapt using their vocals to have a, you know, complete big-sounding record on their album as well. So we're going to be doing the, you know, non-artist production side for some people will be getting producer credits.
And actually, if I have listeners right now that are listening to you that are, you know, budding recording artists, if they wanted to get in touch with you, do you welcome that?
All the time. We, all of our social media, we try to take it upon ourselves to respond to everyone. And usually if there's something sitting in the inbox, one of us will text the other and say, hey, there's something in there. Are you going to respond to it or am I? But we try to get back to everybody. We get emails into our info inbox all the time, and we interact with people, you know, always. We get back to everyone.
That's amazing, because I think so many people would love to know that you're actually answering your own email. That's fantastic.
Absolutely. Every day.
And when it comes to the fact that, you know, like I talked about off the top, you guys are this huge production duo now from Canada. If things continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger, are you both going to have to be in the same city, do you think?
I hope not.
Like the distance, eh, Ryan?
We've talked about it that you know, someday down the road, it may be something that is you know, the situation may have to be adjusted, but I think our thought is the way we'd adjust it is getting together more often, getting into the same city more often. I don't know, Jeff, you really think we'd have to like move in together?
Well, maybe not together, the same city, maybe. But I don't know. I think we've got the, you know, we're a finely tuned machine at this point. You know, our methodology and the way we work works really well right now. I can't really see that need to change in the immediate future, but you know, we'll definitely adjust if the situation arises.
And one thing that really works in our favor is the time difference.
Right.
But with me being here earlier and him being around later, it helps make our cross-Canada endeavors easier.
That is true. That's a good way to look at it. That's great. I think that's fantastic. And, you know, I just wanted to give the listeners an idea because, you know, I think there's a lot of people that can sit at home and think that they're basement DJs, if you will. Can you just give us an idea, you know, how much work it takes to put a hit fix together? Because, you know, we sit there, we listen to it, you know, I know on my station on Virgin 96 in Montreal, we've got your 10-minute version, and then we also have, like, the half hour or the 25-minute version, which we play Friday afternoons. So to do that half an hour Friday afternoon segment, how much or how many hours of work is that for you guys?
I think the bulk is in preparation. You know, everything is really carefully programmed. You know, we not just throw any two songs side by side. Every song that we pick, you know, we listen, you know, okay, does this work harmonically? Does this work tempo-wise? You know, how do the lyrics sound together? So really, I think the majority of the time goes into the preparation. You know, the actual mixing it down is, you know, we've now rendered everything. Everything gets burnt to disc, and we can just play it. So the actual recording of it is real time, but it's, you know, in the preparation is where we spend the bulk of the time. And, you know, it's, between all the territories and all the shows, it's a full-time job.
Yeah, it's a full-time job for two people.
Wow, that's fantastic. And that's amazing because I know that the station, you know, here in Montreal, we love your stuff and we get, you know, requests all the time. When are you going to play it again? When are you going to play it again? So best of luck, guys. And I just wanted to ask you one final question or to let you leave our audience with your final thoughts. What do you want them to know about the Angry Kids?
That we love you guys. We love our fans. And we love Kelly for calling us.
That is good for me. Thank you guys so much. That's Jeff Ryan, DJs Remixers, again with the Angry Kids. Check them out on their Twitter at the Angry Kids or on their website, theangrykids.com.
This process is becoming difficult with everyone around me donating words to my mouth. Who'll make my charitable debut? Reading histories of you, I wish I had the tact. I wish I had the tact. 'Cause you're not generous to me. We'll be right back.
getting too close to the edge.
November marks that time of year when many of you might see the men in your life sporting some interesting-looking mustaches. That's right, Movember is back again this year, and it aims to change the face of men's health through the power of the mustache. This year's campaign is going to be focusing on both prostate cancer and male mental health. Mike Jeffcott is part of the team Three Monkeys and joins us to tell us how he got involved with Movember. Mike, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Mike, how did you actually first get involved with Movember?
My first year in Movember was about 3 years ago, and the team captain of Three Monkeys, my friend Mike Casali, sort of got me involved. I got to say that the first year I was sort of, I guess, bewildered would be the word. After the participation happened, I ended up just going to a lot of bars and doing a lot of partying. And at the end of it all, they told me that I'd helped out. Actually, I felt a little bit guilty, like I was having too much fun. But at the end of the campaign, I looked at the numbers, and we had raised something like $26 million here in Canada. And That sort of got me hooked.
Now, this year's campaign is not only targeting prostate cancer, but also mental health. Why is this something that's important to add to the Movember campaign?
In Australia, the mental health aspect of Movember has sort of been on the table for a few years now, and it really goes hand in hand with any sort of cancer survivorship. A lot of people who have cancer end up getting, you know, mental health issues coming out of it, so it's really a natural second step. In Canada, we started focusing on prostate cancer as our number one benefactor because it was new to the country, and that was the main cause that Movember follows. But last year, we had such a successful campaign that it was evident that we needed to look for a second beneficiary, so it sort of was a natural fit. Movember is also really strongly involved in looking at mental health, sort of male health in general. And it was very obvious that mental health for men was one of the main issues that was not being discussed and that was affecting a lot of men in Canada and worldwide.
Now, for you as a male, is it, or when you first sort of had Movember presented to you and I guess prostate cancer in general, like becoming aware of it, was it disconcerting for you at all to get involved? Like, because I think the pervasive attitude is that, you know, men are afraid to talk about their health.
Yeah, and that's one of the big things about Movember, right, is that you have this mustache that you grow anywhere around. And, you know, not to offend any full-time mustache wearers, but for those of us who aren't used to it, you sort of get a bit of a silly feeling. And it makes everything very lighthearted. So having that mustache is really like a very easy way to get into the topics that Movember is trying to have us discuss, which is, of course, our own health. And I think that, you know, from my own personal experience, you're very right in saying that, you know, men don't typically talk about it. They don't talk about their health in general. You know, we have the attitude, it'll probably go away, or I don't need to see a doctor. And when it comes to things as private as, you know, prostates and mental health, it makes it even harder. But when you have this mustache on and you sort of lead into the conversation with that, it becomes a very natural way to talk about things you otherwise might not want to talk about. So personally speaking, yeah. No, I didn't have a problem with it at all, actually. It was, like I said, it was a lot of fun, too much fun, if anything else.
Did you notice as you were going through, you know, that initial, you know, Movember, that you were talking more to other people? Because I'm assuming you were getting a lot of questions about the mustache.
Absolutely. Especially in, you know, the earlier years, people didn't really have a concept of what the campaign was all about. So, you know, you'd get a lot of looks, and you get looks from people who didn't have mustaches, and you, of course, get a lot of looks from other guys who did have mustaches. So, yeah, you know, people would ask you, you know, what's with the stash? They're used to seeing you with a clean-shaven face or with a beard or whatnot, but not typically with a mustache. And, you know, you'd say, well, I'm doing this thing called Movember. And a lot of people would say, like, oh, yeah, Movember, what's that all about? You know, I've heard of it, but I'm not really sure. And again, it was like the perfect segue into a conversation about, you know, we're trying to look after ourselves and, you know, get the word out that things don't just go away. And especially with the issue that Movember deals with, you know, more than half the battle is getting that information rapidly. So talking about it, getting yourself checked, and, you know, going from there.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, I have, I guess, a personal connection to breast cancer because my mom is a survivor. So obviously coming out of October, it's been a very sort of, you know, important month for me, just knowing that I have a mom who's a breast cancer survivor. Do you have anyone in your life that is a prostate cancer survivor or has been going through it? Do you feel more connected to it because of someone you know?
Well, my father dealt with cancer twice, actually, and managed to survive both. And my grandfather, unfortunately, passed away from cancer as well. But none of those were prostate cancer specifically. I think that, you know, just the cancer aspect of it is something that anybody can feel related to. And the prostate cancer and the mental health issues that we're now dealing with are something that, I guess, as a man, you know, you can feel connected to because, you know, it's something like 1 in 7 of us are going to deal with prostate cancer, and 1 in 5 of us are probably going to deal with a mental health issue. So whereas it hasn't affected my family specifically, I feel like it's something that should be on your radar once you get a little bit of the information about the two diseases.
Now, do you feel a personal responsibility, I guess, to get the word out and hopefully maybe change the way society looks at men dealing with, you know, cancer and other health issues and specifically mental health? Because, you know, I know when I was a kid, you always look up to your dad as like, he's like Iron Man and nothing will get to him. But it's only later that I found out that, you know, my dad, you know, had a few scary moments in his life where he really had to sort of, you know, work through it. And I guess he was the man, so he didn't want to let any of us know. But it's sort of sad to know that he had to, you know, carry that burden on his shoulders by himself. So do you think it's really important that society changes the way that men deal with themselves and especially with mental health issues?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you could explain it any better than you just did. We all look at our fathers like that. And, you know, the idea that a father can have a sickness or even something as simple as, you know, shedding a tear once in a while seems very, lost to people. But at the end of the day, you know, fathers are human beings like everybody else, and they have emotions that, I guess, in their role as father, they sometimes try to suppress. But there's really nothing, I guess, more disturbing than somebody having to go through something as serious as either of these two issues and then not feeling comfortable to talk about it with anybody. So I would say that it even goes further than just prostate cancer and or mental health. I think that it would be nice if people could discuss the issues that they need the most help with in a way that they felt comfortable with. So I think it's extremely important, and I think it's one of the things that drew me to Movember. You know, it really is opening up those conversations. And, you know, you hear more and more stories as you're involved more and more about people who dealt with it. One of the, you know, gentlemen who works for Prostate Cancer Canada here in Montreal suffered through prostate cancer himself, and, you know, he's given speeches at our Movember events saying he didn't feel comfortable talking about it with anybody, so he basically suffered alone. And I can only imagine how scary that would be, and to not even feel comfortable enough to, you know, chat about it with your buddies or, you know, with your family and say, like, well, listen, I got this issue, sort of help me along, give me a pat on the back here, let me know I'm going to be okay. It must be very difficult. So, you know, we definitely want people to feel comfortable getting the word out. And the reality is that it can affect anybody. So there's really no reason not to talk about it.
Joining us on the show is Mike Jeffcott talking about Movember. For more information about the campaign, please go to www.movember.com. Mike, how can women get involved with this initiative? Because obviously, just like you finished saying, you know, this affects everyone.
Well, you know, it's a very typical question that we get either from men who want their, you know, girlfriends, wives, or just people in their entourages to get involved, or girls themselves that say, listen, we can't grow a mustache. What are we supposed to do here? Growing a mustache is obviously an important part of Movember, but I suppose it's sort of secondary when you think about it. The idea is really that talking about it and getting the information out. So what a lot of the Mo sisters, what we call the female members of the Mo tribe, I guess, do here in Montreal is, you know, wear either a pin or some sort of mustache, you know, paraphernalia to show visibly that they're involved. And more importantly, you know, they encourage the men in their lives to, A, talk about the issues, and B, to do the campaign. You know, one of the things that a lot of men run into is, oh, you know, my girlfriend doesn't want me to grow a mustache, or my wife doesn't want me to grow a mustache. She thinks it's going to be prickly or doesn't like the look of it or whatnot. So it may seem very simple, but one of the easiest things that women can do to support it is to say, you know what, we'll deal with your mustache for 1 month. You go ahead and grow it and grow it proud and see what you can do. And that in itself will encourage a lot of men who maybe were on the fence about participating, actually go through with it and do it. That was my own case. You know, I mean, my first year, I had to sort of negotiate the right to grow a mustache, and it wasn't too difficult of a negotiation, but it is something that's on our minds, you know, like what are the women in our lives going to say about our mustaches? So let us grow the mustache, and you know, we're happy with that. And, you know, like I said, general support in that respect.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, what's your, I guess, stance on how the support is for Breast Cancer Awareness Month? Because whether you're in Canada, whether in the States, and I'm sure elsewhere around the world, you know, it is such a huge deal whereby even if you take a look at, you know, professional sports right now, if you watch the NFL or the CFL, you know, the guys are out there on the field wearing pink, which is fantastic. Lots of, you know, awareness for breast cancer. But I'm wondering, do you guys feel like the ugly little sister a little bit yet, that you guys haven't quite caught up to the craziness of the Pink Ribbon campaign?
I would personally say no to that. We, you know, support all of the other responsible charities around the world and in our community, and, you know, we hope the best for all of them. Of course, our focus is on men's health, but, you know, we support the breast cancer movement, of course. The other thing is that in Canada, Movember only came to be in 2007, and worldwide has only been around for just over 10 years. So the fact that we raised $42 million in Canada last year for us is extremely positive. And the important part is not to compare ourselves to the breast cancer movement, which is much more established, but it's just to, you know, do our best on our front and get men's health to be up there with breast cancer as something that, you know, people are aware of and familiar with. So, yeah, we're a little bit behind for sure, but I think the growth of Movember, particularly in Canada, we were the number one fundraising country in the world last year, surpassing Australia, where the movement was founded. I think we're all just very proud to be where we're at after the short period of time that we've actually been doing this.
That's fantastic. And do you have an idea, and maybe this is something that you're not aware of, but I'm just wondering, do you guys have an idea about the percentage of how much a person's dollar percentage goes to research?
Yeah, actually, Movember is doing a fantastic job as well with keeping the administrative costs low. So in last year's campaign, about 89%, give or take a half percent, actually went to programs, which is a fantastic number. You know, best practices for most charities show that between 15 and 25% of the money raised is going to something other than what the actual charity is supporting. So that might be financing, that might be the actual fundraising work or whatnot. But Movember last year kept 89% of all money that came into the program reinvested into the programs and into the research and into the survivorship. That was also, you know, again, taking me back to the things that got me involved in Movember. That was one of the things that I was very happy to see. They're very transparent about it. If you log on to Movember.com, they have a section there that'll say exactly where all the money went. And when you look at the percentages, it's quite fantastic, actually. And it's, you know, makes me proud to be a part of this movement that they're so fiscally responsible.
That's really great, that's for sure, because I know so many people are concerned where their money's actually really going, whether it's Movember, whether it's breast cancer awareness, whether it's, you know, saving the whales somewhere. So that's awesome. And I wanted to ask you, you know, in your personal opinion, what would you want to say to men and women out there about prostate cancer awareness?
I think just to be aware. I mean, the stats are simple. You know, 1 in 7 men is going to deal with prostate cancer in their lives. 1 in 5 men is going to deal with a mental health issue in their lives. You know, that's a tremendously high proportion of people. So, you know, if it's not you personally, it's definitely somebody in your close circle. So, you know, just not to be embarrassed to talk about it, to understand that there are many, many, many people who are going through it with you. And, you know, to know that, especially with early diagnosis, the chances to beat it are extremely good. So the worst thing that you can do is, you know, let embarrassment impede your ability to deal with the issue and, you know, go get checked out and make sure you're on top of things. Because if you are, you know, you're probably going to be good to go.
What's your hope for the next couple of years, Mike, with regards to research and prevention and even, you know, I guess aftercare should a guy be, you know, diagnosed with either A, prostate cancer or B, mental health?
Well, I think, you know, personally speaking, and that's probably a little bit outside of my realm of expertise, but personally speaking, I think the awareness part is what's most important to me. You know, we're all working on a cure for these and many diseases, and the likelihood of finding an actual cure in the next couple of years is probably relatively low, but we will get better at treating the diseases, that's for sure. But in the meantime, just having people, you know, feel comfortable opening up about it and getting that support that they, you know, I'm sure desperately need, is something that is very important to me and myself. So, you know, personally speaking, I'm pretty open about things, but I know a lot of my friends and a lot of my entourage just aren't. By just growing something as simple as a mustache and walking around for 30 days with it can get those people to feel comfortable to open up. I think that's one of the, you know, the greatest things that Movember and the whole campaign can do.
Mike, if someone wants to donate to your team, Three Monkeys, how do they do that?
Easiest way is to go onto the Movember Canada website, and there's a little search box. You can type in Three Monkeys. It's T-H-R-E-E space M-O-N-K-E-Y-S. And, you know, you can donate to us. We, of course, love the donations, but you know, you might know somebody in your life who's participating in Movember, and you might choose to donate to them instead, and that's fantastic too. It's obviously there's friendly competition involved, but the main goal is really to just to get those donations in and get the awareness out. If you log on to Movember.com or you just take a look around you and see somebody, you know, with a mustache and you have a couple of bucks you want to throw their way, that's fantastic. If you want to throw it at the Three Monkeys team, you know, we've been around for a while and we're working hard, so we definitely appreciate it. But the important part is to talk about it and to donate, and it doesn't necessarily have to be us, of course.
Mike, you're awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. I had a good time. Thank you very much for getting the word out.
That was Mike Jeffcott again discussing this year's Movember campaign. For more information, check out their website, www.movember.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
There's a lot going on when you head out on a date. You want to make sure you look nice, that you don't get lost on the way to the restaurant or the bar, and that you keep your nerves in check. On top of all of that, you need to make sure you're following some important rules of etiquette. To help us understand what rules to pay attention to is Toronto-based etiquette columnist, advisor, and blogger with SheDoesTheCity.com, Karen Cleveland. Karen, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Happy to have you back. And right off the hop, what would you consider to be some great first date ideas when it comes to etiquette?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Well, I think mapping out where you want to go and what you want to do is always an excellent place to start. There's nothing worse than that back and forth, like sort of waiting for one person to take the lead on it. So I'm of the mind that whoever has done the asking, it's a good idea to come to the table with some ideas of what you want to do and propose that. And some basic things to keep in mind. So if you're planning on going to a real hot spot, good on you, it would probably impress your date. Make sure to get there really early to nab a table. I don't know about you, but Toronto is plagued with many lovely restaurants here who don't take reservations. So getting there early, figuring out where you need to park, all those things to ensuring you get a table is an excellent idea.
Can I sidebar you for just a second with regards to the hot spot? Here's my question. I guess you should not overcompensate, meaning like, ooh, I got us into this hot place when, ooh, I didn't. You know what I mean? That's bad etiquette, I would assume, if your date's standing at the door and you can't get them in.
Yeah, I mean, it's risky. It's a gamble. But I think it depends on the vibe, too. Like, if it's a really fun place that is perfect, you know, and perfectly conducive to a first date, I say go for it if it's somewhere that you're pretty bent on. But, you know, you want to get there early and nab that table so your date's not awkwardly waiting with you for a 45-minute wait.
Gotcha. Perfect.
Or pick a spot that doesn't require that, you know, grief and takes a reservation and just, you know, sort out your night that way.
Fantastic. Now, a question for you. If you're on the receiving end of the person coming up with the ideas, what's the etiquette on that? Like, do you go with one of the three choices that they've proposed, or do you, you know, be annoying and be like, well, I really want to go over here?
You can do whatever you like, and it might determine if you get asked for a second date.
This
I would
is true.
Think if someone comes is ask you out and they come to you with three, you know, what they think are probably really cool ideas for a date, you know, it might be nice to accept them. It's not, you know, it's not a short list of proposals that you can send them back to the drawing board. At least it shouldn't be.
Okay.
If it is, then Godspeed on your first date. It might not go very well.
It's just because I feel like sometimes, you know, your nerves might get the best of you. And let's say they've proposed three things that either A, you don't know any of those places and you feel like you're going to be nervous going into a new environment, that you might be like, can we go to McDonald's, you know? Okay.
Yeah. I have one friend who's probably the least outdoorsy person I know, but a really, really handsome guy asked her to go on a kayaking date. And it couldn't have went worse, actually. But they're actually been together for a couple of years now, so it's a lovely story. But she absolutely accepted a date totally outside of her comfort zone.
Good
for
her.
So who knows?
It works out. Okay. Now, is it ever okay to go Dutch when you're going out on a date? And how do you navigate that? Because I know that can be awkward.
I think so. I think it's perfectly okay to go Dutch. It's a really personal thing. But when the bill hits the table, I don't care how well that date is going, it can always be a little bit awkward. There might be some presumptions or some assumptions, rather, about who's going to be picking up that tab. So some people prefer to split it down the middle. Others subscribe to the idea that whoever did the asking on the date or the inviting picks up the bill. Other people think that the gentleman still picks up the tab on the first date. To each their own. I'm not here to advise on that. But what I will advise on is definitely avoiding that long out, that drawn out exchange of, I'll get it. No, I'll get it. I insist. No, I'll get it. It's so awkward. If someone insists on picking up the tab, thank them and let them. And then from there, if the date's going really well, you could offer to pick up drinks at the next spot or pick up the tab for the next date.
Gotcha. Okay, that's perfect. Now, what would you deem to be inappropriate when you are out on a date?
Inappropriate or what is appropriate? I guess either.
Yeah, we'll start. You can start with one and then go to the other.
I think phones away is really important. It's a common habit now that we always have our BlackBerry or iPhone wired to our hand. And if you're having dinner, you know, with friends that you see a couple times a week, that's one thing, even though I still have some mixed feelings about that. But date, having your phone out sends a message to the person that you're sitting across from that whatever you're either waiting for on the other end of that phone or that might happen is more interesting than them. And it's really harsh. So I think diplomacy has to supersede, you know, emotions of how well the date's going. And even if it's not going so well, it's just kind of rude to have your attention more to your phone than your company. So phones away, absolutely.
Perfect. And then what else is inappropriate?
Well, it can be a little presumptuous to assume that meals are shared. There's two types of people in this world, I think, people that are really comfortable sharing their food and people that aren't. So you probably want to, you know, really get a gauge on that before you tuck into your date's meal without an explicit invitation to try their dinner. So I wouldn't be too presumptuous with that. And then, of course, table manners are so underrated. So, you know, knowing where that napkin goes throughout the meal and holding doors for each other, those nuances are, you know, they're dated and they're certainly longstanding. I never tire them.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask as well, you know, especially if it is first date and there's all of that pressure going on, even though I know you shouldn't feel the pressure, what topics do you stay away from?
Yeah, conversation starters for sure. Well, I think a good place to always start is how you met. So if it was a mutual friend that introduced you, to maybe chat about how they met that person, or if you met, I don't know, if your professional ties, how they got to that place. But when early days, it's easy to stick to things that you're really excited about and that don't isolate the other person. So what I mean by that, Kelly, is if you talk about nonstop about your friends or people that your date doesn't really know, they can't appreciate your stories. So maybe you stick to accessible topics like travel, what you do in your free time, your favorite places to eat and drink, what you're reading, a great movie you saw. And those are pretty accessible, democratic topics that two people can participate in. Otherwise, conversation can get a little one-sided.
Right. And also, I'm assuming, especially right now, and I know we're in Canada, but obviously the show is around the world. And no matter where you live right now in the world, the hot topic is obviously the U.S. presidential race. So I'm assuming that is something to stay away from, unless it's just sort of on the surfacey.
I don't know if first date is the best place to be getting into any heated political debates. I certainly wouldn't shy away from controversial topics, but I wouldn't be the first to broach them.
Gotcha.
I like to stick to the standard get-to-know-you fare and then, you know, test their mettle as a debater later in the dating process.
On date two, okay. Joining us on the show is etiquette expert, advisor, and blogger with SheDoesTheCity.com, Karen Cleveland. Make sure to check her out on Twitter, @schoolfinishing. How do you avoid the awkward silences or, you know, fill them?
Yeah, that happens in every conversation. You must deal with a lot of that in your line of work.
Exactly.
Those awkward silences. I'm a really chatty person, Kelly, so I can talk the legs off a table. But not everyone is that communicative. So I think it's always good to have a couple topics up your sleeve that you're comfortable speaking to. Bad conversation or slow conversation, that's inevitable. And those things might be good cues to indicate how well the date's going. I wouldn't read too far into it, but if you need sort of a life preserver to pull you out of that awkward thing, I mean, I always try and brush up on the day's news at the very least, so I've combed the headlines so I know what's going on with pop culture or the day's events. Those are always pretty safe bets.
When it comes to, and we're going to sort of go on either side of the gender lines here, what do you think women are looking for, you know, while on that one, two, or third date?
Oh, my goodness. That's a really great question. I think I don't believe in essentialism, so I don't think all women are looking for something and all men are looking, you know, for X or Y. But I do think that all people generally want to feel that the person they're with values their time. They want to feel respected. They want to feel like the other person is interested in them. And I think those are good, safe barometers. And you can't force those things. And we're talking dating here, not forging a professional relationship or a friendship. So chemistry is also really, really important if you're feeling that person.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I think that's very important. And I think you need to be aware of those markers, like as you're, you know, not to be too, you know, hypervigilant, but, you know, to sort of be present. And I think that's another thing, right, to make sure you're present in the date.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. And that harkens back to my earlier point about not having your phone out, like be there, be present and be into what the person's saying and get to know them. And if a date's a bust and you're not failing another date, at the very least, then you made, you know, a new friend.
And how do you actually handle that? Because that's where I would be super awkward. Like, that is where I am not good at getting out of things. Like, you know, I just, because I always feel like I'm, you know, I don't want to let the person down or whatever. So how do you, if you know it's not going anywhere, like how do you, I suppose if you're both don't feel it's going anywhere, then that's not that awkward. Then you're like, you know, it was really nice. Have a nice night, you know. But if you can tell, like, maybe, you know, either dude is into this or, you know, or she's into it and you're not, like, how do you back out of that one?
I wish there was a simple answer. Sometimes you're the punchline and sometimes you get to tell the joke.
Yes.
It happens. And sometimes we just don't click and that's okay. I think we sort of beat ourselves up over that, and there's an entire genre of comedy around that, and it's tough. But I think being honest and upfront and not stringing a person along is maybe the best way to go about it. And sometimes it takes a little bit of time to figure out how we feel about a person, and you might not know that. Maybe it's an instinctual gut reaction. Mm-hmm. But no one, I think, wants to be strung along. So I always think the best place to begin is how you want to be treated if you were on the other end of that. And if a person was upfront and candid and forthright and respectful, I don't think you can ever go wrong there.
Okay. Now, I'm going to throw you for a bit of a loop, I think, but maybe not, because I know that you can handle this.
Ooh.
I feel like this is at the upper echelons of the etiquette spectrum. So what happens if date has gone well? What happens with the sexual aspect? Like, let's say that could be an option, like sex on the first date.
Yeah, I'd be punching well above my weight as an etiquette columnist if I was telling people they should or should not sleep with someone on the first date, presuming that everyone's responsible and adults and safe about it and is in a responsible mindset.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think chemistry can be a really powerful thing, for sure.
Okay, fantastic. Now, this is something else I wanted to broach on, because I know that so many of us have gotten involved in this where we have helped hook someone up with someone else. And then, you know, so there's etiquette about that, meaning, like, you know, let's say it didn't go well. Like, how do you handle that as friends? So how do you handle that if like, you've set up, you know, Susie, and Susie, it was a disaster for Susie?
It's a good litmus test of how well you know your friends,
okay,
isn't it? Like, if you set them up with someone and you're sure it's going to go well, and it goes down in a blaze of glory, or the opposite, maybe introduce two people and you're really surprised they get on. Who knows? Like, relationships always look so different from the outside than they are from the inside. So if you're bold enough to set up two friends, I think it's important to recognize the implications around that, though. So if you set up two people in your immediate social circle and things go sideways, that's going to affect the friend dynamic between everybody. So it's just something to be mindful of.
Okay.
But if, say, you know, Susie didn't get on with the date that you set her up on, and she's wondering, what does this mean for her? I think, again, honesty is the best policy. And maybe, you know, you explain a couple reasons why you thought they might hit it off or what they had in common. But I think that, you know, you don't really owe an explanation beyond that. You're not the town matchmaker.
Right.
You know, it's not your full-time job to employ your friend's love life. But I think it's, you know, pointing out the things that you maybe thought why they would get along well is a good place to start. And then, you know, get their feedback. And then vow to never set them up ever.
Right, exactly. And I wanted to ask, too, about, okay, so let, you know, let's say you did, you know, set up Susie with your friend, you know, Rob. How does that go after with the post-mortem? Like, maybe each of them are going to want a post-mortem with you. Like, how, like, etiquette comes into play there.
Yeah, that's really precarious territory. Because if you have two friends who had a horrible date with each other and they're both venting to you, it's not good. So either be upfront where your allegiances lie. So Rob, you know, I'm sorry you had a really crummy date with Susie, but I gotta let you know, my allegiances are with her in this. She's my oldest, dearest friend, or she's my sister, as you can appreciate, something like that.
Okay.
But if you're equally close to both people, put an embargo on the conversation and just say, you know, you can speak to pretty much anybody but me about how terribly this date went, because I, you know, as you know, I'm really close to the other person, and it would be unjust of me to hear that from you, and I'm promising the same to them, as you can appreciate, and just remove yourself from the situation entirely.
I think that's really fair, and I think that's something that you need to take to heart, like all of us that are listening, because it's so easy to get caught up and then turn it into the Young and the Restless, and we don't get paid enough to play that.
And how terrible if you were on the other side of that? Like, would you want, you know, a guy that you had a horrible date with talking to your friend about why he thought you were so lame? That'd be awful.
Yeah,
so
awful.
Avoid it altogether.
Okay,
yeah.
Very good. Now, before I let you go, what would be your, I guess, biggest piece of advice with regards to this, you know, situation with the first date and how to handle it and how to end it well, kind of thing?
Don't overthink it.
Okay.
Don't overthink it. If someone asks you out or you ask someone out and they accepted, they clearly want a bit of your time. They want a little bit of your time. So don't overthink it. Go on a date. See how it goes. Take it for what it is. I'm of the old adage that, like, people come into your life for all sorts of reasons. So maybe it's just to check out a great new restaurant. Maybe you meet a great friend. Maybe you end up introducing this person to their future husband or wife. Maybe, you know, maybe it goes splendidly. Who knows? But just relax. Dating.
Gotcha. And relax, be present, have a good time.
Absolutely. Put your phone away.
Fantastic. Okay, perfect. Karen, thank you so much for joining us again. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Kelly, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's etiquette expert, advisor, and blogger with SheDoesTheCity.com, Karen Cleland. Make sure you check her out on Twitter, @schoolfinishing.
Bring on the remix.
I don't lie. Promise to break your heart at least 2 times. Come on a journey of a jam. And just come up, rehearsals for a show. But she don't know the truth. And if she only knew that I was linking another chick that isn't you. And look inside.
That's Luke Bingham with Gemini, the Manhattan Clique radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. As always, a big thank you to my guests. This week, the Angry Kids, as well as Mike Jeffcott and Karen Cleveland. I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Confucius. The will to win, the desire to succeed, the urge to reach your full potential, these are the keys that will unlock the door to personal excellence. Now, don't forget to check out our YouTube channel. We have lots of people subscribing, as well as lots of videos up there for you, including all of our celebrity interviews, as well as our weekly segments, including Kim Airy, our dietitian, talking about kids' nutrition. It's very important, so check it out, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. As well, don't forget to check out our website, www.KellyAlexanderShow.com. Lots of goodies up there for you as well, recipes, quotes of the day, as well as our blog posts. And we'd love for you to follow us on Twitter at K Alexander Show. Have an awesome week. If you have any comments or questions, as per usual, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great one. I'll talk to you soon.